Hi, this is Eric Schlein of the Intelligent Investing Podcast. Today's episode of the Intelligent Investing Podcast is sponsored by Red Rock Running. Runners and joggers out there, tell me if this sounds familiar. You go into your local running store to pick up some gear, first the shirt, and as you browse the shirts, you see that nice, high-quality performance shirt running you at least $40. Then, you need something to carry your smartphone so you can listen to the Intelligent Investing Podcast while you run. Or maybe you want to track your run with a GPS. A smartphone carrier costs something like $20 or $30. And between work, family, and other responsibilities, the only chance many of us have to go for a run is early in the morning or late at night. That often means running in the dark. So, to help stay safe, you need a reflective vest to increase visibility. That's another $10, $15. So, in total, you can expect to spend over $100 just for gear that goes on your upper body. Red Rock Running has a better way. Their new Bryce running shirt combines all three of those products into one simple item. Secure pockets built directly into each sleeve carry your smartphone or other audio device, a couple of keys, headphones, or energy gels. Strategically placed, reflective material increases your visibility, keeping you safe when running in the dark. Intelligent Investing Podcast listeners know the importance of value. Purchasing a technical shirt, smartphone carrier, and a reflective vest separately costs over $100. The Bryce running shirt, however, gives you all three for only $59. And Red Rock Running is offering listeners this podcast an additional 15% off any purchase by using the promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So that's right, listeners, if you are a listener of the Intelligent Investing Podcast, you get an additional 15% off any purchase of a shirt that's already a good value by using that promo code INVESTINGPOD at checkout. So remember, go to Red Rock Running, REDROCK, running.com, and receive 15% off your Bryce running shirt with promo code INVESTINGPOD, INVESTINGPOD. Carry more, increase visibility, decrease hassle.
Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
This is Eric Schlein with the Intelligent Investing Podcast, and we have a very special guest with us today. His name is Matt Millard with MRM Properties based out of North Texas. So welcome on, Matt.
Hey, Eric. Good to hear from you again.
Yeah, you too, man. How you been?
Been great. Loving this weather right now. We're getting the early fall.
Very cool. And you're near the Dallas-Fort Worth area, right?
That's right. I'm right near the airport.
And so tell us a little bit about what you do. You know, you're in real estate. But just, yeah, tell us a little bit about what you do, who you are.
I started out, luckily enough, at 18 when I was a freshman in college at OU in Norman. And did some single family rental properties and would literally house hack, which is I bought a 4-bedroom house and lived in the master and rented out the rooms and was able to give people a pretty good deal and live for free. And from that, I started learning more about management and acquiring additional properties and all that kind of thing.
Very cool. Now, it's very interesting because we met at a Berkshire Hathaway meeting. And for the listeners out there, that's the company run by the very famous value investor Warren Buffett. And it's interesting because most of the people that I meet in that community are doing more with stocks, and you've taken a different approach and have gone into real estate. So tell us a little bit about how you've applied value investing principles to real estate.
A big part of value investing to me is looking at margin of safety. Things like book value, moats are extremely important. In real estate, when you look at a moat, whether it's a single family house or an apartment building or something like that, you're looking at the employer base and the local economy and the vacancy rates and trying to determine what your competition may be. And it's really like Buffett does. It's about having great managers and forming partnerships with them to kind of enable them to do what they do best every day.
Interesting. So when you talk about a moat, right, when talking about a moat regarding a company, right, having the competitive advantage, right, Buffett uses that analogy of the larger the moat, the harder to
to get in and destroy that company, right, with the competitor. So how do you look at moat or what, competitive advantage when you're dealing with real estate, if you can elaborate a little bit more with that?
Okay, yeah, definitely. So to look at moats in real estate, you have to consider things like a great location, a great management. Is the property being sold at a discount? And if so, why? Is it mismanagement? Are there issues with rent rolls and existing tenants, things like that? And just take all that and apply it to kind of make an overhaul comprehensive decision. And then you're looking at the track record of the manager, where they started and kind of where they're going. And you're buying either into one property or one complex or a set of properties, and have to kind of apply that to everything in the portfolio.
So are you not managing the real estate that you invest in?
Well, I started at 18 and did rentals in Norman around the OU campus.
Okay.
And I actually didn't really have to manage too much when I lived there, because I was literally just a college student house hacking, renting out the individual rooms. And then after that point, when I got additional ones, I started leasing to grad and law students at OU in different groups and got more experience. And after moving back to Texas and having some friends and kind of managing it remotely for a while and learning some, you know, tough challenges and lessons going through major renovations, things like that to protect the rents long term. I eventually hired a management company and even had to go through some lessons on the management side too.
Okay. And then do you use the same management company for all your real estate investments? How does that work for you?
Well, actually, I've gotten to know quite a wide variety of management companies here locally and across the area. Primarily focus on deals in Texas and Oklahoma that I can drive to within one day.
Okay.
And the management company I had originally, they served a good purpose for a while, but wasn't a great long-term fit. Ended up switching companies, was really happy with that, and then sold the portfolio properties to my brother about a year ago, and he's now running those with the same manager and getting some similar returns.
Gotcha. And then when you said you know, you said earlier that when you're looking at buying a piece of property, right, one of the things you look for is if it's being sold at below market rates, or, you know, some kind of insanely cheap price where you have a margin of safety. What exactly are you looking for that you can weed out, you know, a piece of crap that's being sold compared to something that seems like a good investment?
Well, one of the things you have to look for is, especially in apartment complexes, they go by class. So it kind of ranges from A to D. And the returns are much higher typically in the C's and the D's. And there's a lot of downside protection or margin of safety in those properties.
Yeah, how are you looking at that? And how are you determining the downside protection on the C's and the D's?
Well, on the C's and the D's, I kind of look at the area and the base of the tenants, typically blue collar and others that make up that area. You just know that if you have good management in the area and you kind of take care of your tenants, that it'll be a win-win in the long run. If you're investing in Class A, say in Houston a year or two ago, and we hit the oil crisis in the country we hit, those are some of the first units to become vacant, and it can kind of throw all your projections off. So I typically stay away from anything above a Class B.
And just for the listeners out there, can explain the difference, the class system to those listeners.
Okay, Class A would be like a high-end granite countertops, updated fixtures, modern appliances, things like that. A Class D is going to be a place that's livable, but it may have popcorn ceilings. It may be really old. It has good bones as far as the boiler, the air conditioning, and the heating. It has good structure as far as the foundation of the walls. But outside of that, it doesn't offer a lot of additional amenities, and it's not going to be as near of a desirable area of town. It may still be close to a major city, but not in the heart of the shopping and the wealthier neighborhoods.
And then explain the other letters.
Okay, so B, C, and D are just slight steps down from that. So B and C would be the middle, and those are your middle-class properties that are kind of offer appliances and features in the middle of that range. So in a market like Oklahoma City, you'll have Class D ranging as low as $500 a month in rent right now, and Class A would be over 2,000 in some cases. Most of that middle ground in the Class B, C would be probably $800 to $1,200, and it's definitely going to vary by market, because real estate is a very low location based, and it varies so much from city to city and state to state.
Right. Interesting. So now you said you started at, you said 18?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to have a lawn service and some other businesses and stuff growing up. And I made a spreadsheet and partnered with my father and was able to get the first property. And was able to run the whole property for about $700 a month, and I could bring in close to $1,500 a month.
Interesting.
And so I just made a financial model and a spreadsheet and kind of projected it out over time and kind of looked at the interest rate of my loan, the factors, the maintenance, and then the properties were newer. They were actually close to campus, and they were probably a B-plus single-family house. You can rate houses the same way. It's more common with apartments and private deals. But anyway, I applied that to that purchase and did that analysis and basically tried to follow it the best I can. And like I said, we're doing the renovations. That's another kind of house hacking. There's a strategy called buy, hold, rent.
Okay.
And you renovate too. It's known as BRRRR. And that was something I was already had the properties and needed some upgrades when I was moving out of town and everything, and was able to get some friends and contractors and go kind of do it on our own for a few days in between tenants to kind of protect the rents for the next couple decades.
Interesting. So we're kind of in the same boat in that we started investing. So you started when you were 18. I started, you know, near 18. I was 17 doing stocks. Would you say that there's been some advantages for you starting pretty young?
Yeah, I definitely think starting young was a huge advantage for me. And actually, I come from an equities and a stock background. I was actually more of a mutual fund type investor growing up. My dad did stuff with Templeton, Select American Shares, Vanguard, stuff like that. And we used to discuss a lot of those funds. And when I had jobs and things growing up, I was able to start investing at an early age and do things like a Roth IRA. And that gave me kind of some insights at a young age to kind of prepare me to make a move into real estate, because I couldn't really jump into real estate, even in a cheaper market like Oklahoma,
right,
until I was older and had the right situation and fit.
No, and then when did you start learning about Buffett?
I was lucky enough to be interested in finance growing up and the other investing, and I read the articles and Kiplinger's and things about it. Actually, that kind of connects back to Omaha, talking about some of the Berkshire shares and the bar mitzvahs and the different things. And on top of that, I also learned a lot about it through books. I bought Roger Lowenstein's book on Buffett. I had several others and was kind of able to learn those in high school and college and put a collection together that had always inspired me to buy the shares and go to Omaha. And I owned the shares on and off for 3 to 5 years in high school and college.
And then what had you – so two questions for you. So first of all, that book you mentioned, amazing book. I read that in a night when I was in high school. Like, incredible
book.
No,
that is absolutely phenomenal. And the one that's kind of the modern-day version that I just finished is Warren Buffett's Ground Rules, which is like a top seller at Barnes & Noble right now.
I've never read it, but I should pick it up. Oh, yeah. So the two questions I had for you is what has been Buffett's influence on you investment-wise? And then the second thing is, what had you start going more towards real estate?
Okay, if I was going to break down Buffett's influence on me, there's a lot of history. There's a lot of cool fascination of it. I mean, I love reading the stories about Rose and the Nebraska Furniture Mart and her journey with that, working on the floor till 96, and just some of the values and the balance sheet of the company. And actually, the largest furniture store in the world is just down the street from me that Buffett opened here recently. But so I would apply it to three major things. And I would say really learning about just value investing as an idea, getting exposed to that world. I didn't like Wall Street and a lot of the finance and things that I saw out there in the world, and wanted to find something different that I thought would be better and make more sense as an investor that I could kind of use and do for decades. And I also wanted to learn from the very best. And if you look at the history of funds, there's some phenomenal histories with Sequoia and various others. But Berkshire, as far as overall size and track record and history, is probably still the gold standard. I mean, just being a couple years ago with you at the 50th anniversary was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I'd say margin of safety, learning about moats, and then meeting other like-minded investors. And I guess that final thing would be how good he was at identifying great managers and then giving them the capital and not actually hassling them. He would rather withdraw the investment and do something else than hassle the actual managers. He would literally search for the cream of the crop of the best, which if you're trying to beat the market in a world of Vanguard and index and efficient market hypothesis, that's probably the only way you're going to do it by a substantial margin over decades. And the 60s and 70s for him were a ripe time to apply and do those things. And it's gotten a lot harder to do today, but there's still some advantages that can be found. And, you know, we'll go through more hard times like 08, but value guys usually always come out on top if they stick to their principles.
Yes. And just in your own personal life and in your business, are you putting money with other managers? Is that what you mean when you're looking for when you're looking for good management?
Yes, I became a limited partner in several different partnerships in the last few years. And I mean, to go back a second ago, how I decided to really jump into real estate. I had so much success in real estate with the first couple houses and the renovations and the tenants and learning things, going through ups and downs over that decade, that when 2008 happened, and I saw how real estate's a lot more consistent. And when there's a crash like 08, I actually made more money in Oklahoma on the real estate than, I mean, everyone suffered stock losses then. And so that was kind of an eye-opening.
Wait, hold on. Most people suffered stock losses in 08. I'm just going to leave it there.
That is true. It's the far majority, but there are a few exceptions.
Yes.
Definitely. Go ahead.
No, keep going.
Repeat that last question. I lost my train of thought.
Yeah, so I asked you how Buffett's influence has been on you and what you do, and then how you sort of moved into real estate. Because, you know, most people who are into Buffett end up getting more into stock. So it's different, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on.
Yeah, it's definitely different, and I'm definitely glad that I did that. It helped meeting people like Scott Thompson and getting on websites like BiggerPockets and reading articles about people taking value investing techniques and applying them to real estate and kind of sharing their success over time.
Yeah.
And people that were also really long-term thinkers, and they believed in the same thing as good managers and margin of safety, and we just had a lot of similar goals and values. But after that,
by the way, Scott Thompson, even I had invited him to come on the show. This is how much he cares about margin of safety. He wanted me to have a few other people on first before he came on. So I think he wanted to see to make sure this was going to be a legitimate show and that I was going to stick to my word and keep bringing on guests before he put himself on a show. So even when it comes to podcasting, he wants a margin of safety.
Yes, and I hear and agree. I've listened to some of the stuff he's done with Fox Business and elsewhere in the last couple
really
of years.
Really smart guy.
Definitely, and I was lucky enough to know him from Omaha and see what he did with his move from Minneapolis to Tampa a couple years ago and get started in the business of flipping properties in bulk with a team. And I've lucky enough to become one of his investors and get involved and meet some of the other investors and clients and stuff.
Interesting. So you find, so kind of like how Buffett has found managers over the years to put, you know, to put capital with and kind of let them do their thing. You kind of taken that principle and have done the same thing with real estate. So there's, you have some of your passive investments, but you're also doing some active management too. Is that correct?
My brother does some active management, and I have friends in commercial here in Dallas. And we are working on taking a piece of land that my mom and some other family owns and developing it into long-term ground leases.
Okay.
And trying to attract a complimentary shopping center across from what's already called the Riverwalk, where there'll be like a hotel and a movie theater and several restaurants and lights to anchor it.
Is your brother part of your company too?
My brother is definitely influential with it and has invested and done similar things with me, definitely.
Okay. So what would you say are the pros and cons about active versus passive management or passive investing in regards to real estate?
I would say if you really will put the time in and master it and you'll really take the attention to detail, make the site visits, really get to know the managers, talk to the other investors, read through 300 pages of private placements, things like that, and then kind of get to know the area and the location and really study the market you're investing in. Because I also invest in assisted living, oil and gas, and I do single family owner finance with a couple guys up in Oklahoma City.
Okay. Now, for people who don't want to get that involved, what's a good place to start if you want to get involved in real estate from a passive perspective?
If you want to get started from a passive perspective, there's some bigger companies that do turnkey, and they'll find and manage properties, and they'll offer you some kind of return, and it's not so much correlated with the stock market, and you can benefit from that local area and employers and environment. That can be a decent way to go, but honestly, probably acting like you're a little more active and going to a local REIA or Real Estate Investor Association meeting and meeting other investors and finding people that are doing owner finance or hard money, or they're flipping properties or different things, and kind of learn about the different strategies.
Yep.
And then maybe partner with one of them and come up with a win-win situation where they can borrow, say, a fixed loan out of your IRA at a certain rate to run their business, and you have a good long-term relationship that you can build. That's kind of blurring the line between passive and active. That's kind of what my career has been focused on, is blurring that line.
Okay, so now the way your company is set up, are you do you have your own real estate fund, or are you invested in other funds?
Well, it's not technically a fund structure. It's an LLC and a partnership.
Okay.
But I invest as a limited partner in a series of different deals, and then certain deals have offered better tax and partnership benefits by actually setting up another LLC and connecting those together, like I did in Oklahoma. And so just depending on the structure and the deal, right now I'm evaluating some mobile home park investing that's located mostly here in Texas and has some of the top managers in the country, but it would probably be the largest size fund and managers and type of deal I'd ever been involved with.
Okay, so let's use a real life example, if you don't mind. What do you, when you're looking at potential to do some mobile home investing, what are you looking for? How are you coming to the decision whether you'll make an investment with that or not?
Well, honestly, I just seriously started this due diligence process again a couple of days ago as I came across the opportunity.
Yeah,
I actually found a guy in Los Angeles who runs his own smaller kind of Berkshire Hathaway type meetings with other investors, but he manages a series of limited partnerships, and he's about 15 years older than me and is in about 70 different deals versus my 7, and just has more track record with experience and working with other investors and a bigger size. I think he's about 50 million. And so looking at the people that he works with and studying the management, and then I actually know some of the training because one of the mobile home park investors and principals is from North Texas and has done that around here since the 80s and 90s, and also had a billboard in another company. So just kind of like studying the principle of that, I'll probably go out and take visits to the actual parks like I do with assisted living to meet the nurses and the management, or in the case, the park manager, and see the properties and kind of look at it on the ground after seeing the placement. And then I always look at the size of the deal, the potential returns that are offered. I try to get to know any other investors that I can. If I end up joining this deal, I'll probably go out to their shareholder get together in Orange County in February.
Okay, got it. What would you say the most interesting investment case study that you've ever been a part of has been?
It's interesting if you're just going to look at investment case studies, because in college I had a really great class from a volunteer adjunct professor that owned an oil and gas company in the entrepreneurship program, and we would do Harvard case studies.
I want to hear something that you invested in, though.
And we would do SWOT analysis. Okay. You want to hear analysis for...
Yeah, for something that you've invested in. And you know, we've been talking a lot about theory and what you look for. What's and I'm putting you on the spot here, but what's been some kind of real estate investment that you've made in the past, and kind of break it down for us how that looked like?
Okay, I would probably pick my first apartment deal in Oklahoma City with Nick and Cameron, and that would be lower in class DC properties. They would be kind of right on that line between D and C, about $500 a month in rent, 16 units. Something that wasn't well managed, that a lot of the wealth management and apartment management in Oklahoma City kind of wasn't paying attention to. And I just saw Nick and Cameron's strategy to bring in like a bilingual property manager and really work on things like the insurance side, which doesn't sound that important, but in apartment investing in a state like Oklahoma with the weather and tornadoes, it's and hail, it's a big thing. And then kind of like really getting to know the numbers. It's kind of easier to evaluate the rent rolls on a smaller property sometimes and kind of see how much upside there is. And it was kind of a lower risk way to get into it, just based on the amount and the minimum and meeting, you know, some of the other people that were older than me that are local up there that invested also.
Okay. And what is the – have you ever made a mistake? Have you ever lost money on a deal?
Yeah, I've definitely made some mistakes. Luckily, some of the mistakes I made were not too costly or too consequential at the time. As far as when I hired the one management company, I made a mistake as far as evaluating how well that manager would take care of my individual needs as a property manager, which is a big issue when you pick a manager, because they're probably managing 800 to 1,000 properties across just a small city like Norman. They're one of the dominant groups in town.
And what kind of issues did you have?
Just not as much communication about things, getting invoices for repairs that were above and beyond what I had experienced when I was doing it myself. I understand you can pay more, but a lot of the times they're supposed to have partnerships and agreements. But if there's not really good transparency between the manager and the owner, then that can create issues. And then there can be things going on with the tenants behind the scenes that you might not realize, stuff like that. And then on the renovation side, doing it myself and, you know, kind of DIYing it with some friends on the first couple of properties, I definitely learned some hard lessons about materials and supplies and making mistakes. And then even with tenant selection, because time would change between leases and I'd have the property advertised and I'd have to go through the process of collecting income and credit and just various different things to make a decision on the property, which in a college town, there's an additional benefit that a lot of people don't realize. But if you're in a better property near campus and you can attract three or four people to live in it, you're actually going to have a joint lease with all of them. And if they don't qualify financially on their own, you can have parents guarantee the lease. So you can almost have four families guaranteeing one house, which takes a lot of the risk out of a typical lease in a college town and makes eviction and other issues much more unlikely.
So would you say there's almost an advantage in investing in college towns?
Yeah. The only one downside I would say about college towns is if there's a if universities, like what happened with ITT Tech last week, if there's an education bubble that pops kind of in general,
yeah,
there's always going to be a need for college and higher learning and things, but there could be kind of a temporary setback in those markets. But as far as schools that are more well-known that have above 25,000 enrolled,
yeah,
in a good area and kind of you really have to look at things like the cap rate and the rent ratio. Like I complain sometimes about cap rates in Houston and Dallas right now at around 6 to 9 percent. And talking to people out in California and L.A. and San Diego, they're, you know, happy to get 2 on a property.
For real?
And it's just a matter of
perspective. Is that true? They're happy to get 2 on a property?
Yeah. It's actually even
2%?
Be a worse situation in places like Palo Alto.
Wait, hold on.
San Francisco.
They're happy with 2% on a property?
That is what's happening in the higher end spots. Jeez. In the major cities. It's happening in New York and Chicago and elsewhere too. You don't feel that effect as much in the South and the Midwest, Florida, Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas, states like that. You can find some much higher cap rates. Tennessee is another good one. One of the best turnkey real estate companies in the country is called Memphis Invest.
Okay.
Out of Tennessee.
What kind of cap rates are you seeing in Tennessee?
They've fallen a little bit from where they were, but cap rates are probably around 8 right now.
Okay. But you like to stay local though, right? You're saying?
Yeah, I definitely like to stay local, but if the opportunity is compelling enough or most of it's local, like most of these mobile home parks are in Texas and a lot of them are in North Texas and there's a couple outside ones. As long as you know the management is leaving that area because they found a really unique one-off deal,
mm-hmm.
That helps kind of ensure things. And then I was lucky enough to surround myself, not just through like a RIA and like the real estate investor meetings and stuff, but I found just other groups of investors here and get togethers in the area where people are doing all kinds of different deals and a lot of people putting together apartment deals, and kind of got to know some of the principals that are older and more experienced than me that would kind of help me become a better passive investor and active if I wanted to be. I just don't think that active is necessarily the right fit for me right now. I think I'm better off bringing returns to me and my partners through the best passive deals I can find and kind of proving performance, not in one quarter or one year, but over decades.
You know, when you say partners, do you mean people that actually have investments with you, or these are people that are working with you?
It's a combination of both. I'm really small right now. I'm right around $1 million in size.
Okay.
And just have a couple of partners right now, and that's it. I've looked at kind of opening it up and going outside, but haven't quite found that fit for me. I've had a couple people that are friends and family that joined me in a deal on their own.
Okay.
Without necessarily joining. Since I don't have a fund, I'm not taking actual money in, but they would invest on their own alongside me.
Got it. And if someone wanted to potentially invest alongside you, what would be the way to contact you if you don't mind sharing that?
Yeah, I have a Facebook page for MRM Properties, and I also do most of my business via email. My email is investormillard@gmail.com.
And spell Millard out for everyone.
Millard.
Okay, and then MRM Properties on Facebook.
MRM Properties on Facebook.
Very, very cool. Anything else that you think is relevant to share, or anything else you'd like to say before we wrap it up?
Well, I just thank you for the time, Eric, to do this, and just your friendship and knowing you from Omaha from the early days in 07 and 08, and just all those good things, and just wish you the best with your own fund and your own political career. I definitely am involved politically and have a lot of interest in that area, and I just wish you the best with that.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that. And for the record, I do manage to count. There's not a fund structure, but I get the sentiment. I appreciate it.
No worries.
All right, great. And again, if anyone wanted to contact you about potentially talking to you further about investing alongside with you, it's MRM Properties on Facebook or Investor Millard. Did you say at gmail.com?
At Gmail, yes.
At gmail.com. That's Millard with two L's.
That is correct.
Great. Well, thanks so much for coming on. And this is Eric Schlein with the Intelligent Investing Podcast. And Matt Millard with MRM Properties was our guest today. And we'll see you next time. Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.